This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you remember your sex education? Was it helpful to you? Was it filled with scientific information rather than real, practical advice? I'm Diggory Waite, and this is The Real Sex Education. Each week, I'll be joined by a guest. We'll impart our own sex wisdom, ask our own sex questions, and we'll go over all the things they don't teach you in school. To bring this all together, though, we'll need an expert. A sexpert, if you will. But the only sex and relationship therapist I know is my mum. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
In this episode, we speak to Dr. Magdalena J. Fossey about polyamory.
Polyamory is a complex experience. It's not one emotion, but many.
We talk about the future of dating, jealousy, and why people become polyamorous at all.
It's tongue-in-cheek, but it's true. I haven't heard anyone so far say, I'm interested in more love in my life, so I want to open up our relationship. What prompts most people in my experience is a desire to be involved sexually with more than one person.
Hello and welcome to The Real Sex Education. Each week we try and give you the sex education you never got from school, and today in class we'll be covering polyamory, otherwise known as non-monogamy, with our wonderful interviewee Magdalena J. Fossey. The thing is, in today's lesson there's lots of technical terms that we need to get up to speed with before we go on. Luckily, I'm joined by accredited sex and relationship therapist, Kate Campbell. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
So we're going to have a definition from our brilliant interviewee a little later on. But just for now, Mum, what is polyamory or non-monogamy?
So what it says, really, non-monogamous relationships where you've got more than one partner. So you might have one special partner and others, or you might have a sort of hierarchy of partners. There's all sorts of different ways of doing it, which Magdalena will discuss with us. But what's really important is that this is not the same as an affair. It's a relationship where everybody knows what's going on. There's no secrecy, or that there shouldn't be any secrecy. Yeah.
Yeah. And a monogamous couple or monogamy is the opposite. It's like you have one partner and that's that.
Yeah, most people go in for serial monogamy, don't they? One partner, then another partner, then another partner, then another partner, rather than several all at once.
So with polyamory, as I say, there's lots of technical language to get to grips with, and Magdalena uses a lot. So here are some of them. What's a formation?
Well, that's any kind of group of polyamorous people. So quite often that would be four or more in the same kind of group. So they could be all having sex together, or one of them having sex with another one.
And another one and another one at separate
times. And another one and another one. Yeah, yeah, at separate times, yeah.
So it's like a network, a sex network.
Yeah, yes.
And a dyad.
Two, a couple.
Yes, and so a dyad is like, yeah, the relationship between
two people.
Yeah. And a triad.
Three.
There you go, or a thruple. But a triad is also made up of three dyads, because the dyad refers to the relationship between two people.
Yeah.
And another one as well, it's symbiosis. Now, obviously, that means something in, I'm sure, like chemistry or something, but that's not the lesson we're doing today. Symbiosis, what does that mean in the sexy relationship-y term?
So this is what happens when the people involved create a kind of relationship that they are comfortable with, where it's balanced in the way they want it to be, where it's connected in the way they want it to be. So it's something that has been worked at to be achieved.
Mm. And compersion is another one that Magdalena talks about in the podcast. And she actually gives her own description or explanation of what that is herself. But basically, compersion is something that you don't have to be polyamorous to feel it. You've got to be in a relationship with someone, or, you know, have a relationship with someone. And it's that feeling of not just acceptance or tolerance, but joy and happiness in seeing someone else being happy, doing something else with someone else, almost like the opposite of jealousy, actively enjoying them being happy, even though you might not be involved. And that's something that a lot of polyamorous people sort of strive for. And this one is very specific to Magdalena, in which she talks about the clinical reality of things. And it's because she is a therapist and she sees a lot of these couples and thruples and formations, etc., and or just people on their own. And she mentions the clinical reality of things. And when she mentions the clinical reality, that just means when someone is sat opposite her in the therapy chair,
talking about what's going on for them.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And so I think that's our primer.
Yay.
I think we're ready.
Ooh, ready to go.
Exactly. So let's hear, she's with us now, sex therapist, clinical psychologist and author, Dr. Magdalena J. Fossey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
For people at home that don't maybe know, can you explain in your own words what you do and how you came to do it?
So I'm a clinical psychologist, which implies that first and foremost, I work with individuals, and I'm a couples therapist. So I work with relationships, and I think I work with individuals and couples in equal measures. And by couples, I don't necessarily mean that it's only monogamous couples. It's couples of all sorts. And I'm also a certified sex therapist, which means that my main focus of therapy is relationships and intimacy and sexuality. And because of my particular interest in polyamory and non-monogamy, the vast majority of referrals are from people who are considering alternatives to monogamy. But it's equally important to emphasize that I work with people who are in monogamous relationships. For me, the most important thing is the quality of the relationship, not the format. The format doesn't define the quality.
Just in case there's anyone that doesn't know, what is polyamory or non-monogamy? Is there a difference between the two?
That's a great question. So polyamory is a made-up word which consists of two elements, poly meaning multiple and amor meaning love. So multiple love, and implies the possibility to be sexually and romantically involved with more than one person. Non-monogamy implies sexual relationships with other people. So non-monogamy can be seen as an umbrella term under which polyamory is one of the ways of practicing non-monogamy. But just like with non-monogamy, there may be so many different presentations, so many different formats, from swinging to polyfidelity, which is a form of polyamory within a group of people where they practice being sexually involved with one another, but nobody outside of the group. So these terms are often used interchangeably. So I differentiate, but I also specify or talk to people how they want to be called.
And so when your clients come to you, polyamorous or non-monogamous, what are they usually looking for?
So they are coming to me for relational help. So it's also like I want to acknowledge up front that who I see and then what I'm seeing in terms of relational difficulty is not necessarily a reflection of polyamory or non-monogamy on the overall, because I see people in pain. So when they make their way to my office, they are already struggling with something. It's also true that many of the people that I have worked with over the years, they come to the world of polyamory thinking that they are prepared. They typically say that they've read books about polyamory, they followed blogs, they listened to podcasts, and they concluded that's who they are. Then the second step is that they come to my office and then they talk about, like, we thought we were so well prepared, and here we are in pain, and we don't know what to do.
What sort of thing tends to prompt people to start thinking about polyamory or non-monogamy in the first place?
Going back to like how polyamory means multiple loves, it's interesting in itself that the term doesn't involve sexuality, but again, what prompts most people in my experience is a recognition within themselves that they have a capacity or the desire to be involved sexually with more than one person. So it usually starts with sexual interest and then and a hope that their relationship can contain and tolerate more than one sexual liaison. But also then with hope that maybe it can be more than an acceptance of more open sexual boundaries, that it can also accommodate for loving romantic feelings. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it's true, is that I haven't heard anyone so far say that, you know, I'm interested in more love in my life, so I want to open up our relationship. People are interested in more love, they find a way to incorporate more love. So it can be love deciding to have children or another child, inviting more friends to their lives, and then strengthening bonds in the relationship or in the family of origin, or having pets. So love is not necessarily a conflict per se. It can become a conflict when it becomes a romantic entanglement with somebody else, and it starts to represent a threat to the existing relationship.
Ah, so do people ever think, oh, here's an idea, another partner, when they get a bit bored with their sexual relationship?
Yes.
Ah.
Very often the case. Or if they identify as something else than straight or gay, and actually internally they are feeling, no, that's not who I am. I want to have space for multiple relationships. And if they can be space for a different and normative sexual exploration, that's where I belong. That's what I want.
So I want to give a little bit of space to what you said before, is that you see more people who are, like you said, you use a great phrase, in pain. And that's the case with both of your professions, I guess. Like when you do see relationships, that's when they're in struggle. What do polyamorous relationships that are flourishing, that are positive, what do they look like?
Well, that's another terrific question, because it's also a question in what stage of the relationship they are. It's very easy for relationships to appear flourishing when they are in the early stage of symbiosis or the honeymoon, or to use polyamorous terminology, when they are in a new relationship energy or NRE. So those relationships look flourishing. All relationships go through stages of development. And it doesn't matter whether we are talking about monogamous relationships or non-monogamous relationships. Any long-term relationships goes through certain stages of development. So starting with the stage of symbiosis, falling in love, the honeymoon, and then going through the stage of differentiation. The differentiation implying, like, I'm different than you are, and can our relationship tolerate the difference? And the stage of practicing, like, can our different ways of being in this world coexist? Can we be individuals and be together? And then the stage of, which is called, often referred to as rapprochement. So the stage in which the differences actually are not as important. They are recognized, but they are appreciated, because that creates something different. And the final stage that not all couples achieve, which is the stage of harmony. So the harmony, where the recognition of that we are stronger together than alone, is the dominant field. So again, now going back to, it's like, are we talking about monogamy or non-monogamy? And then how the flourishing relationship exists? Yes, if they are flourishing, they've already came to the place of recognizing our differences are our strength. And we also are stronger together than alone. So it's like, if the relationship can tolerate and accommodate for differences and doing it successfully, that's the model of flourishing. So if there is a polyamorous formation who comes to my office, it's usually a dyad, whichever, like whether it's a dyad of the primary partners who, or it's a dyad of a partner, one partner who is primary with somebody else, but it's coming with another person to therapy. So it's still, the focus is on the dyad, on the quality of this relationship, and can this relationship flourish?
Mm-hmm. So you'd get the impression from reading some of the literature that they're able to eliminate jealousy from the relationships.
Yeah.
Is it as easy as that?
No.
Ah.
That's one of my pet peeves, is that as valuable as all the writings on polyamory are, and because they can help people to discern, like, is it something for me or not? In my mind, they also oversimplify the picture about how to deal with jealousy. So there is the message, a very clear message about polyamory being a complex experience. It's not one emotion, but many. And that's absolute truth. So it's jealousy consists of feelings of sadness, anger, envy, of a sense of insecurity, and many other feelings of guilt or shame. So that all goes into jealousy. However, jealousy is not one person's emotion. Jealousy is in response to relational threat. So that's where, when the focus becomes on, like, it's on you as a person to deal with your jealous feelings, that approach overlooks the reality of jealousy being a complex relational experience. So it's also, it brings it back to, like, how is the relationship handling jealousy? What is the other partner doing to make jealousy less prevalent? So again, it's not taking the responsibility away from the individual, but in my mind, the emphasis should be again on what's happening relationally and individually.
Right. So how is the other partner helping?
Yeah, or not helping.
So is that something that people come to see you about a lot? Is that a, because I would imagine that would be a big issue.
Yeah, absolutely. and also with compassion. Compassion implies being able to find the joy in seeing one's partner having fun with somebody else. And in the polyamorous world, it's emphasized that fun with somebody else doesn't have to be of sexual nature. It can be more broadly understood. But so many people, when they read about compassion, they become really excited. Mm. On the one hand, they think like, really, is that possible? And on the other hand, they think like, oh, it's something that I need to aspire for. So the world of polyamory actually creates a different set of pressures expressed by that, like, I'm not doing polyamory right. Because if I was doing it right, I would be feeling compassion. But again, the question is, watching one's partner having fun with somebody else because they are engaging in some activity that doesn't feel threatening, is that compassion? Or is compassion something that actually implies working over something that is difficult for an individual to embrace and tolerate and reach this higher level of acceptance? The question is, again, over and over again, if it's really challenging for you as an individual and for the relationship because it feels like a threat, what can be done to overcome these feelings? And is it even a state that it's achievable?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I would have thought it's not just having fun with somebody else. It's the activities, the particular activities they're involved in, like going to the same restaurants or maybe being interested in extreme sports that worry the primary partner or something like that. And it must be a minefield trying to get your head around it and manage all of that sort of thing.
Yeah. So going back to jealousy, so from jealousy and compassion being perceived as the opposite of jealousy, I look at them as two different phenomena. One is like, it's jealousy. It's not always a bad thing. Jealousy has a bad reputation. Jealousy is a signal that there is something in the relationship that feels off, that it's threatening. So jealousy can be also a signal that, wait a moment, we need to refocus on what's happening for us, how to strengthen the relationship. Vice versa, when people don't feel compassion, it doesn't mean that they are not giving the relationship the attention that it deserves. It might mean that they are acknowledging, you know, this is not easy for me. It doesn't mean that I cannot continue striving and doing my best in this relationship.
Yeah. And do you think there are different times in people's lives when it might be harder to have your partner seeing somebody else?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Again, thinking about what's polyamory and how does it play out, it's always a question as well, like, which generation are we talking about?
Mm.
So, like, for you, it's a very different reality than for somebody who is, let's say, in their 40s and thinking or being introduced to polyamory and now realizing, oh, I think I'm really interested in it. So let's say it's a couple in their 40s and now they think polyamory is intriguing. They want to explore it. And if it happens to be a couple where both partners had very little sexual experience, so there is also this sense of like, wait a moment, we are middle-aged. There is not much time left. But we still are curious. We still want to explore who we are. And then to be, you know, it's life is not over. On the contrary, life is in its fullness. But is it all there is? So that's a very different scenario. And then very different approach to different relational options and sexual options. So again, it's like it's such a complex world, which is like in which to apply one definition and say that's what it is. In my mind, it's really difficult or actually almost impossible.
Yeah.
But it's interesting though that you mentioned them maybe being in their 40s, because something that you said before, Mum, was that a lot of the polyamorous clients that you've seen are people who are
over 60.
Yeah. Is that something that you've seen as well, Magdalena?
Absolutely. And I'm actually, since you mentioned it, so I was also curious, because what I see is the reality in the US. That's where my clients come from. And I assume it's similar for you in Great Britain, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, yes, that there is also a lot of polyamory amongst younger people. I mean, it seems very doable, very acceptable in the gay community and pansexual community. But more problematic for straight cis couples, really. And as you said, with the older, the much older, there are more of those things. Do you think this is all right? I'm widowed. I don't want to leave my home. I want to keep my home for my children. I don't want to set up a new home. I have multiple friends and have lots of relationships. And they seem to manage it really well. And there seems to be much less sense of jealousy in the older people. What there is instead is guilt about doing something that goes against what they've been brought up to believe in.
Yes. And also I'm thinking about the guilt feeling might be there, but it also might be a recognition that once more at a different stage in life, different needs might dominate. So it might be, let's say, if it's another kind of imbalance in the relationship, like one of the partners is, let's say, not interested in continuing sexual intimacy for medical reasons, some other reasons, it doesn't mean that sex is gone out of the relationship or desire for intimate connection. And again, that's a separate part. It's like when we talk about sex, it implies a mutual understanding of what sex means. Sex is not the same thing for everyone.
No.
Sex is much more than penetrative sex, which is how most people think about still. So that's another conversation. What do people mean by sex? What do people mean by intimacy?
Yeah, and it changes at different times in life. I mean, sometimes people are more into it than others. And we see lots of menopausal women, for instance, who say, oh, well, I'm menopausal, therefore, you know, I'm going to go off sex. But they're not off sex. What they're off is feeling really sweaty and uncomfortable. And it doesn't feel very sexy when you're feeling like that. And it's the perimenopausal symptoms that have put them off sex, not their libido. Their libido is intact.
Yeah.
But it's misread and it causes all sorts of problems. So this is also true. We spend practically every podcast saying sex isn't just about penetration every time.
Absolutely.
And that's an important message, because going back to the premise of your podcast, the real sex education, sex is so much more than penetration.
So much more, so much more. And, you know, there could be different kinds of really amazing sex with different partners. Yeah. So if say, you did have somebody who was ill, lots of cuddles and sensuality and eroticism might be really important, but with no penetration and maybe no orgasm, maybe not very much naked touch, but some maybe, who knows. But then with another partner, there might be lots of penetration and lots of swinging from the chandeliers and a very different experience. But it's all brilliant sex.
Mm-hmm. And is perhaps that one of the draws of polyamory, is that you can sort of find partners who fit in all of them? If one partner doesn't do all of those things, I suppose, that way is treating people like sort of, I don't know, like a box-ticking exercise. But is that one of the pros of it, is that you can find people that fit all of your different wants and needs sexually?
In the ideal world, yes. It's like ticking off the box. There is nobody who can meet all of your needs. The question goes back to, like, is it creating a conflict? So let's say, again, two people, a couple, and then in which person loves reading books and the other person loves going to spectator sports. Is it a conflict or is it something that they are able to manage with friends who have similar interests? And then when it comes to, like, to relationship and sexuality and intimacy, you know, I have different interests. So let's say now it's a couple in which one person is interested in kink. Now it's a different question. What kind of kink? Because a kink which involves having the blindfold on, it's very different from kink in which involves going to dungeons and exploring things that for somebody else can feel threatening. So it might be ticking off the box, or it might, and the relationship might tolerate, or it might actually represent a relational threat. I don't know who you are, what you are doing, and it feels like you are doing it to me because you want something that I cannot tolerate. It feels too dangerous, too risky. So you feel dangerous to me. So both can be true, ticking off the box, or it can also be true that it becomes a conflict in the relationship that a couple may or may not be able to resolve.
And is it, I mean, I guess with all these things, is just really good, thorough communication the best way to deal with those sorts of conflicts?
Communication is the key, but communication alone doesn't solve the problem. What's happening in the relationship in the present is affected by what people experience in the past, in their families of origin, in their previous relationships. And all of these things can affect what's happening in the moment. So being able to openly and honestly communicate, which is one of the tenets of polyamory, openness, honesty, and transparency, all of them are building blocks. But also being able to engage with the difficult parts of one's personality or one's past, it's relevant. And making space for that, rather than thinking that we're communicating well because we're problem solving. Relationships are not all about problem solving. They are also about making space for different emotional experiences.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you think more people are becoming non-monogamous? And do you think, I mean, some people said it's the future. Do you agree with that?
I'm really curious to see how it unfolds, because it's also back to the generational differences. For people your generation, Deacon, and then for people even younger, it became such a household name. So they don't even know who they are, but they are already talking about being polyamorous. So if a 14-year-old talks about, like, I'm poly, and they have barely experienced anything in the world in terms of intimacy, sexuality, and then relationships. So it's really hard to say how this perception of relationship will of themselves in the world, how it will continue down the line. And looking back at history, we are continuously evolving as species, but also the struggle between the original question, as species, are we monogamous, are we not? Even that doesn't have a straightforward answer, because there is no indicator of a species being monogamous. And yet monogamy has existed culturally for millennia. And also it was never like in a strict format, because every culture on the earth has found a way to work around monogamy. You know, we are incredibly adaptable. And then moving forward, probably non-monogamy will be accepted part of our future. And there is also the question about, like, you know, when people are in the stage of forming a relationship and wanting something more lasting, how would that concept of non-monogamy work for them? So that's the big unknown. And how will we regroup? How the world is changing, and how will we regroup around that?
I mean, I think I can see it amongst my friends and peers now and people my age. I mean, there's obviously dating apps, and people will, you know, they'll go on a few dates. They might sleep around a lot. That in a way is a form of sort of polyamory, just because one of the big questions you're asked now, if you say, oh, I'm seeing someone, people next will ask you, my age, they'll say, oh, are you guys exclusive? Mm-hmm. So it's the idea that you could be seeing someone, but at the moment, even amongst my age group, it's like you're not instantly assuming that the person that you're seeing is definitely your primary partner and you're exclusive. There could still be other people that you're seeing and other people that you're sleeping with. So I think, you know, like you said, it's interesting how I think it's already unfolding in front of our eyes, and it could well be the future.
Yeah, because the language is changing. So people might not talking about being monogamous, but they are talking about exclusive. Mm-hmm. And that's still relevant and important, because that indicates the seriousness of the relationship. Are we exclusive? We are moving to the next stage.
If there is somebody listening to this who might be thinking before, oh, it's not just a crush, I do think I am poly. Like, how do they proceed? What do they do?
You're asking such a big question.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. I'm so sorry.
That's terrific. I would say, actually, go to therapy. Absolutely. Go seek help. Go to therapy. Make space for your own growth and exploration. Because we think, most people think or assume they know who they are. We really don't. And without having a mirror, without having a space in which you can reflect, in a space which is non-judgmental, which is open, and then in which your individuality can be embraced, it's really hard to get to know oneself. We don't exist in vacuum. We need mirrors. Other people are mirrors. So again, who you are with, like in terms of your partners and friends, is our mirrors. Who your family is, our mirrors. Therapy is a neutral space. Neutral in a sense that it doesn't mean that the therapist doesn't have any preconceived ideas about the world. Therapists have their own biases too, but it's finding a good match with a therapist in which you can actually deeply dig in and into who you are, and then come back to the question, like, is this true for me? That would be my advice at the end.
I think that's wonderful advice, and it's really struck home. Magdalena, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much as well. It was a delight. What a wonderful initiative.
Oh, that's so kind.
Thank you. It's wonderful to meet you.
Bye-bye.
It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries. Twopodcasts@hatch.com. It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries. Podcast at Hatchick with two T's.
Hello there. I have a query for Kate. I would like to know when the real sex education mailbag starts.
The real sex education mailbag starts right now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Dr. Magdalena J. Fossey for speaking with us. You can find her at drfossey.com. That's drfosse.com. And you can buy her book, The Many Faces of Polyamory, Longing and Belonging in Concurrent Relationships, there as well. We'll put both these in the show notes, as well as Mum's blog that goes along with this episode and tells you a little bit more detail about what we discussed today. And also, it has a wider reading, listening, and watching list that includes a polyamory glossary. So if you enjoyed, you know, learning all the words at the beginning, you can impress all the romantic partners in your life by knowing exactly what terms to use to refer to them by. Right, Mum, it's time to open up our mailbag and see what questions our listeners have for you to answer. If you'd like Mum, an accredited sex and relationship therapist, to answer your questions, you can send them in via email, podcasts@hatchick.com, or DM us on Instagram. We're at RealSexEdPod. Question one today comes from Anonymous, who says, I was having sex with my boyfriend and he pulled out his penis and my vagina came out. I screamed and pushed it back in and it's been fine since, but I'm really scared. Help.
It sounds like a prolapse.
Mm.
So when other organs like the bladder or the rectum and of course the womb are pressing heavily down onto the vagina, then it is pushed forwards. And so you will quite often see the uterus, the womb, to appear at the opening to the vagina when it's been pushed down. But where you've got a lot of pushing, then parts of the vagina can be pushed forwards. And that's probably what she saw. But I mean, it doesn't happen so often during sex, because when you're aroused during sex, normally the womb moves backwards during sex. And normally you don't actually have that problem at that time. So I would definitely get that checked out by a doctor. Prolapses most commonly happen after childbirth, which is why you're encouraged to do pelvic floor exercises. So guys and gals, please do your pelvic floor exercises. It's really, really important. And actually, it's really important anyway, because it stops you from becoming incontinent and it can really, really enhance your sexual functioning. I mean, like lots of people say, they can have more orgasms, they can control orgasms, they're more intense. I mean, you know, it varies from person to person, obviously, but there's definitely good reasons for pelvic floor exercises. And you stopping your vagina from falling out is absolutely one of them.
I really couldn't quite believe my eyes when I read this. And to know that it's possible is terrifying.
Well, so, it isn't really possible. What it means is that a part of the pelvic floor has been pushed forward. And it's potentially there was a full rectum behind it that was pushing it forward. So it's not falling out. I mean, it isn't actually falling out, but
Their turn of phrase is, I think, what's frightened me.
Yeah, the turn of phrase is quite comical, but well, it's obviously not comical to them. It's obviously very serious. But and it is very serious and you should go to the doctor.
Yes, but you've mentioned the pelvic floor exercises. Is this the famous Kegels?
That's the ones, yeah.
So how the hell do we do our Kegels then?
Well, if you go to the loo and you stop the flow, those are the muscles, when you stop, those are the muscles that you want to exercise. So don't keep doing that or you'll get a urine infection. But you can just do it once, not if you're pregnant, but you can do it once if you're unpregnant.
So whilst you're peeing, you then clench, stop, and then start again.
Yeah, so that, so then you know that's the muscles. So what you want to do is do the clenching quickly, do lots of quick clenches, say 10 quick clenches, and then one where you hold for 10, and then maybe do five where you hold for 10, and then do 10 quick clenches again. Are you doing them? You look as if you're doing them.
I'm doing it right now. Was it that obvious?
Yeah.
It's quite hard.
It is quite hard.
Really quick. How hard? How quick do you
really,
have to do
really,
them?
Really, 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 get them really, really quick. Really, really quick.
I can't do that really, quick. Really, this quick. Is insane. I could do about one.
Yeah, I know. But once you get used to it, you can do them really, really quick.
I can't do it that quick.
Right. If you're climaxing and you do them, sometimes you can delay your climax or you can make it happen. If it's slow, you can make it, guys, you can make your climax come by doing this. And you can also make your climax more intense if you get good at this. Apparently, I can't actually vouch for it. obviously, because I'm lacking some parts, but apparently that's supposed to work. And certainly,
to be real, I was like, what is she talking about? What's she lacking? Right, got it.
And I mean, some women can climax just by doing Kegels.
Oh my word.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a little tip is, if you have just climaxed and you're about to be penetrated, that's a really good time to start doing your Kegels, because penetration straight after a climax, you can then control further orgasms with your Kegels. So you can have more orgasms as you're penetrated. That's a really good way of doing it.
Well, that sounds like a superpower. So go away and try that one at home.
Yeah.
Here's one I prepared earlier. Fantastic. So, Anonymous, go to the doctor, get that checked out, and everyone else, and probably you anyway, do your Kegel muscles. Mm-hmm. Our next question is from Alex, who says, I am straight, but I like watching gay porn. I have been thinking about being with men more and more recently. I'm really confused.
Well, is Alex a man?
This is what I was thinking. But I imagine Alex is a man, because it's like, I'm straight. I've been thinking about being with men more and more recently. But then again, that could just be like, like Alex, the girl, being like, I'm doubling down on being straight.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Alex is a guy.
Right, because there's a difference in the way people tend to perceive erotica and porn. So women are more likely to identify with the characters. I mean, so it doesn't matter who they are, they will identify with them. So they could identify as straight, but be really turned on watching men or women having sex together, because they identify with their experience. And so they get turned on by that.
Yeah.
Whereas men tend to be more detached, and they're not aroused by the person, if you like. They're aroused by what they're seeing. So women, what is hot is the person's experience, whereas what is hot for men is the person's behavior.
Right. Hey, that's good.
But either way, it doesn't mean that because you appreciate non-straight sex that you are not straight. I mean, it might do. It might be the first signs, but it doesn't need to be. It's likely that you're just appreciating the scene.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I was just about to say, I think I've said it before on the podcast. I have, they've all been friends of mine who are girls, who they've said to me before, they're like, I identify as straight, but I've watched lesbian porn and I really enjoy it. And again, it's exactly what you say. They're like, I'm not like, oh, this lesbian scene or whatever is really, really exciting. Mm. It's like, I identify with the pleasure they're receiving and like the situation. That's literally what they've said. So you're exactly spot on. So it could be exactly the same that's happening here. However, at the same time, it could also be, like you say, the first signs that maybe there is something else going on. The thing is, and what I would say if that's the case is I think particularly for men, and for a lot of people, but there's this sort of internalized homophobia going on. And I think as soon as you start being like, oh, well, that could be gay or whatever, you're just putting labels on it. Just try your best. Just, if you're enjoying something, keep on enjoying it. Don't put too much thought into it. Don't try and be like, oh, does this mean I have to put this label on now?
Yeah, but it's a personal experience. That's the thing. And I think, when we talk about fantasy, which we have done a few times, where we've said that what's going on in your head is in your head. What's in your head stays in your head. A lot of women have rape fantasies. That does not mean they want to be raped at all. Mm. And you know, there are some arguments that when something is bothering you, you will turn it into a story that helps you to master it.
Mm.
And so it could well be that, you know, that's what's going on for Alex. But it could also just be he thinks, you know, it's a hot fantasy. It's just a fantasy. It doesn't mean anything else. But if it did mean something else, so what?
I think that's it. I think regardless of what's going on here, I think you're really confused. I think don't be confused. Just accept these things as they come. You cannot help your thoughts. You can't help what turns you on. Just keep enjoying yourself. If you're enjoying watching gay porn, you literally say here, but I like watching gay porn. Keep doing it.
You know, there are all sorts of reasons why people like things as well. And if something is a little bit taboo, then that might be why. I mean, if you feel, well, I shouldn't really be doing this, woohoo, that might be.
Yeah.
I bet Alex does that every time he goes, woohoo, whenever.
Yeah. He's like, ooh, I'm straight, but I'm watching gay porn. I shouldn't really be doing this. Woohoo.
Yeah, that's how he goes.
Amazing.
Sorry, Alex.
Sorry, Alex. Keep at it, though. Keep at it. Oh, well, what fun. I can't believe it. What fun. That is about it for this episode. And, Mum, would you believe it? That is it for this series.
No.
Series three of the podcast. Yeah.
No, you're kidding me. That came round really fast. 10 up, 10 down.
I know. So fast.
Oh, no.
And so it's about that time in the series where we have to say thank you so much to everyone, to Hattrick Productions, for hosting us for another series. We really appreciate it. Claire, in particular, thank you so much. You're the best. Mum, as I said already, it's been another wild ride.
Yeah.
You're a constant source of information with incredible insight, such as saying that one way toxic masculinity shows itself in men is by them feeling like they can't eat quiche. Or the fact that when you said to that lady who was like, oh, I don't want my daughter to have her boyfriend around to stay, she's only a teenager, you were like, don't worry, they'll be playing Minecraft.
I didn't say that.
This is a good thing. Listeners, you can go and check the tape, see what she said, see if I'm being harsh.
The thing is, you started saying that, and I thought, oh, he's saying something really nice. He's saying, he's saying, I know what I'm talking about, and all you're doing is taking the mickey.
No, come on, let's be real. You are a resident sex and relationship therapist. You are our sexpert. You know what you're talking about. I mean, those questions that you just answered, that's exactly right. So honestly, though, it's been great fun. It has been really good fun.
It has been really good fun. I've had a blast, Diggs. Thank you so much.
And last but certainly not least, thank you guys for listening.
Absolutely.
We wouldn't be here without you. And I don't like to pick favourite children. I'll leave that to Mum. But listener, just know that if you were my child, you would be the favourite. And I'd buy you a 99 with a flake in it. And all my other children would just get a 99. No flake. All right.
It's not a 99 without a flake.
Yeah, I know that because I'm your favourite child. Can't you get a 99 with no
flake?
The
whole point is the 99 has a flake in it. Otherwise, it's just a cornet, isn't it?
Well, get this, right? Do you know what's even darker? Is I would buy them all 99 flakes and then take out the flakes.
What?
To my lesser favourite children. But to the people listening, I'd keep the flake in. So all the other kids who don't listen to the podcast, they just watch on as Dad ruthlessly took their flakes out of their ice creams.
Right, this is not to be recommended at home, listeners. It's child abuse.
Yeah, if this does happen, I have a fantastic therapist that I can refer your children to, which is good. Guys, stay subscribed, stay following, because we'll see you there for some more real sex education. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Real Sex Education, which is hosted by Diggory Waite and Kate Campbell. The show is produced by Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. The Real Sex Education is a Hattrick podcast.
This podcast is based on the real-life relationship between Diggory Waite and his mother, accredited sex therapist Kate Campbell. The show is therefore inspired by, but otherwise unrelated to, the TV show Sex Education. But yes, Diggory does wish his mother was played by Gillian Anderson.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.